I have to go upstairs and record something again, so
quiet.
Quiet and do not
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
Hi, you're listening to Pandemic, a new podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Cullum O'Mungoyne, and most days of the week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. The sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat sometimes, as correspondents and I will be recording this, in many cases, on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Monday, May 25th, and as we record this in the early evening, nearly 346,000 people have died with COVID-19 around the world. In Ireland at this evening's briefing, the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan, said there were no deaths of people with COVID-19 in the past 24 hours. There have now been a total of 1,606 COVID-related deaths in Ireland. A further 59 new confirmed cases of the virus were found, bringing the number of confirmed cases to 24,698. Elsewhere in this episode, we're going to have a look at the press conference given by Boris Johnson's advisor Dominic Cummings in London about his movements during the lockdown. But first, back home at the briefing this evening, Dr. Tony Houlihan was addressing questions about the recommendation that people stay 2 metres apart to reduce the risk of infection.
So all the measures that we have in place, all our public health advice is under constant review. I was asked about this one last week and indicated that, look, it's something that on a continuing basis we look at the evidence in relation to. That particular measure, it's simply a case of the risk that attaches to spread of infection when people are at a distance of 2 metres is less than if at a distance of 1 metre. But it's important to understand that on its own, no more than, and I've talked about this in the context of things like face coverings, it is not a magic thing on its own. A measure of 2 metres does not mean that everything is safe outside of 2 metres and everything less than 2 metres is less safe. It's a risk. So that if the average distance between people is 1 metre, the risk of transmission of infection of this kind is greater than if it's 2 metres and greater than if it's 4 metres and so on. And we think for the moment 2 metres is a reasonable compromise given where we are. But that's something we keep under constant review, and I understand the position that businesses will have articulated in relation to some of those kinds of measures. But it is important that each of these is understood, not just on its own merits, but how all of these measures, in other words, the whole package of public health advice that we give, each component interacts with each other.
Now, earlier today, the World Health Organization's Dr. David Nabarro addressed the same issue when speaking to RTE Radio 1. This is because several business groups have cited the WHO in support for their call to reduce physical distancing to 1 metre from 2 metres. Dr. Nabarro clarified what the advice was.
When a person coughs, the droplets that are associated with a cough come out of that person's mouth. Most of them don't travel further than 1 metre. Very, very few of them travel further than 2 metres. So over the years, the World Health Organization and others have said the best distance to keep away from people if you want to avoid inhaling a droplet from somebody's cough is 2 metres. That basically keeps you safe 99% of the time. But you can greatly reduce risk even at 1 metre, because around 70% of the droplets will stick within 1 metre. So that's why what we always have to do is to offer advice that talks about risk. And we think that if you really want to reduce the risk of picking up the virus from somebody who's infected, please stay at least 2 metres away from other people. But if you're in difficulty and you have to get close, for example, you're providing care or you are in a factory where 2 metres distance just doesn't work, you can still greatly reduce risk by being 1 metre away. And every time there is a decision made by a government or by a supervisor in a factory, it's always a case of weighing up the balance of risks. Can we keep the business going with 2 metres physical distancing, or is that going too far? And should we reduce it to a slightly lower level? Answer, if you get closer, then the risk slightly increases. I hope that's clear to your listeners.
Yes.
We're going to have a look at the politics around all of this shortly with political correspondent Micheál Lehán, but first let's go to our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers. All right, Fergal, how are you?
I'm good, and the weather is good too, so that's helping, I think.
Yeah,
everybody give a bit of a lift, perhaps.
Yeah, also obviously a push on people to get outside and want to mingle with each other. And what we're seeing is increasing questioning over how closely people can mingle. This debacle over the 2 metres, it's obviously something that restaurants and everybody else are keen to have clarified. And there was some use of the WHO's remarks to say that 2 metres was a bit excessive.
Well, should people stay 1 metre or 2 metres apart to protect themselves against getting coronavirus? And there are a number of factors involved in that. You know, are you inside or outside? Is there ventilation? But effectively, the World Health Organization position on its website advises that at least 1 metre and ideally 2 metres from one another. And then if you look at the European Centre for Disease Prevention and Control, it recommends that you stay 1 metre or more away from people. Now, in the early days of the first cases here, so in March, the advice here at the Department of Health was to keep at least 1 metre and ideally at least 2 metres from one another. So there was that, you know, I suppose you could call it wriggle room. But later on, the National Public Health Emergency Team settled on 2 metres as their interpretation of the European Centre for Disease Control advice. So that has been the position, you know, up to now. Obviously, you know, a metre matters depending where you're coming from. If it's business, it could be the difference between being able to open or not open a restaurant or other business. And then from a health point of view, you know, is there much of a difference between the two? Now, the 1 metre, the European Centre for Disease Control, it doesn't definitively say it should be 2 metres. So 1 metre is okay. If you look at the World Health Organization or if you look at the European Centre for Disease Prevention.
Yeah, well, we heard David Navarro saying it's 99% potential protection if you're 2 metres apart, whereas that drops to 70%. So the risk, there is clearly in double figures a higher percentage risk if you reduce the gap between people to two from 2 to 1 metre.
Yeah, so it's a balance of risk and choice here, which is what he was saying. So, you know, 2 metre distance, it does keep you safe 99% of the time, he was saying, but you can generally reduce your risk by keeping 1 metre away. And that he was saying that 70% of droplets will stick, so they'll stop within 1 metre. So, you know, if it's a risk and a balance of choice, that's one thing, because people can decide to exercise that when they're out and about, you know, in terms of distance they keep from people. But I guess in terms of a business, there needs to be absolute clarity, like what can you operate and what can you not operate? And that's why restaurants and other businesses are obviously saying, well, we need absolute clarity as to what it might be. Now, people are going to be looking to the National Public Health Emergency Team maybe this week to, you know, comment further on that advice, but it hasn't changed at the moment in relation to 2 metres. And there's political and other pressure to allow businesses open, but businesses to open with 2 metre distance versus 1 metre, you know, it's a huge thing for a business.
And we'll be getting into that shortly with our political correspondent, Micheál Lehán, about the growing political pressure to have a look at this in terms of business considerations. But hospitals, Fergal, is another area you've been having a look at, and bed occupancy within hospitals as a result of COVID-19.
Yeah, and we've been, you know, whenever we've chatted, we've been tracking this, you know, in most of the podcasts we've done. And so if you look at the latest figures, and these are HSE operational figures overnight, we can see the number of people in hospital with coronavirus or suspected coronavirus. It's down to 521. And that's down quite a lot. There are 49 patients in intensive care units with the virus, plus 20 with suspected coronavirus. And there's 126 critical care beds vacant at the moment, which, given the current capacity, it's sufficient for the demand on the system as we speak. However, the number of general beds that are vacant is reducing.
And that's what's behind that, Fergal? Because you would think of, are more people presenting at hospital, or what's the reason behind it?
Well, more people seem to be turning up at hospital. I think today about 50 or so patients were, you know, in emergency departments waiting for admission to a bed. It's still a low number. But we do know from the HSE the number of people attending with non-COVID, conditions is increasing. It's still
at
a low level.
It's not good for the people concerned that they're ill, but there was a serious concern heretofore that people weren't presenting at hospital when they should have been presenting at hospital.
That's right. And at this point, more people seem to be attending, which is important. If you look at the number of vacant general beds, there's 735 vacant general beds in the hospital system. Now, that does reflect what we're saying there, more non-COVID care and activity. But there's also, built into all of this picture, there's around 400 patients in acute beds. Now, their clinical care has ended. So they are ready for discharge from hospital, but they can't go home yet. For example, they can't go home because there mightn't be some backup care that's needed for them to be able to go home, or perhaps a Fair Deal nursing home care bed isn't available, or also under the current rules, a person needs to have two negative COVID-19 tests before they could be discharged from a hospital to a nursing home. So there are a number of factors built in there as to why these patients can't yet leave the hospital bed.
And yet, Fergal, you would think with the amount of testing capacity that there is in the system, conducting those two tests wouldn't be all of that much of an issue because the testing situation has improved.
It has. I mean, when you look at the tests, over 310,000 tests have been done so far, and the positivity rate is 2%. So that tells you 98% of all tests are negative, which is good news. And it remains a very positive scene that we have at the moment, that coronavirus is not in the community. It has been in some meat factories and it has been seen in nursing homes. But effectively, if you look at the number of positive cases you're seeing, it has been driven out of the general community. And long may that last. And ideally, if we see these numbers continue to go down, then we will be going into phase two and into phase three. You'd be optimistic that that will happen. All nursing homes and all mental health facilities have been tested. The staff and residents have been tested in those. And the HSE is working towards completing disability centres. And I think those might be all completed within about a week or so.
Finally, Fergal, then, the report on the matter has been completed and it's with the Minister for Health. We should hear something about that. You would think relatively soon. This is the reporting of historic cases.
Yes, and it has gone. It will be published, I think, soon. It was sent to the Secretary General of the Department of Health there, I think, on Friday. And Paul Reid, the Chief Executive of the HC, commented on it. We know from it that the Mater Hospital did report the cases and met all of its legal requirements in doing so. It appears some data, I think identification of people may not have been fully completed, but it wasn't the case that the matter failed in its legal obligation to report these cases. So there'll be lessons to be learned from it. And we, hopefully we'll see publication of that report. There haven't been any other similar incidents at all. And so there's no concern that this has occurred or is a problem with other hospitals. So it seems to be an isolated issue that arose.
All right. Well, yeah, Fergal, but just before we leave you, the issue of nursing homes has come up consistently. There's been quite a degree of infections amongst staff who had worked in nursing homes, and obviously the death rate or the percentage of people who have died in residential care homes in the community has been quite high. It's going to be looked at. What do we know at this stage about that?
This is an expert group that's been set up by the Minister for Health. I mean, it's very much to monitor what best advice is in terms of that sector. I mean, it's not an investigation group to look at in fine detail, what happened in nursing homes, the lessons to be learned, a probe type group. It's not really that. If there was to be an investigation, I think it would be constituted in a different way. But it is an important group, although there has been some criticism that perhaps this type of group might have been beneficial at the start. And then there's also some criticism that there's no GP on it, or there's no representative from the private hospital, from the nursing homes, private sector on it. It's a small, tight group. So I think we're going to hear an awful lot more about nursing homes when the Doyle Committee on the COVID-19 response gets into that matter. There are supposed to be two major hearings on nursing homes, and we should see, you know, documentation that involved in the whole area, letters, emails, and any communications between, say, the nursing homes Ireland and the department being published, and we'll get a better insight as to what alarm bells were being rung, when they were being rung. We've dealt with some of this before in earlier podcasts, and what the response was in terms of the primary issues that were personal protective equipment, relief staff because of pressure on homes. And also that one of the crucial issues is what was being done in the early days in terms of the discharge of patients from hospital to nursing homes. Were they being tested? Were they not being tested? Were many patients discharged from hospital to nursing homes that had the virus, and did that cause a problem in certain areas? It's very, very important material to be examined, and it will be examined at that committee.
All right. Okay, thanks, Fergal.
All right, take care of yourself.
Cheers, thanks. Bye-bye. Now, as you heard at the outset of my conversation with Fergal, the 2 metre recommendation of physical distancing has become something of a talking point in recent days, not least in political circles. I've been talking to Micheál Lehane, our political correspondent, about what pressures are building on this front. The 2 metre rule, Micheál. Last week, it was all about 2 hours in a meeting. This week, it's about 2 metres distance. I'm detecting a bit of a theme here.
Yeah, definitely. The rule of two, it seems to be. And there is pressure building politically, maybe not at the top of government, even within the cabinet themselves. You can see statements being issued saying, well, it's the ministers that only dip in and out of the detail around the health policy that are becoming engaged on this. But there's no doubt, speaking to a good number of people this morning in different parts of the country, in political circles, this pressure is on that if it was reduced, the social distance measure from 2 metres to 1 metre, then that would allow a lot of businesses to reopen. There are ministers picking up on this, and the push will come when they meet the chief medical officer and NPHET, probably at some point in the next few days. I think as it stands this evening, they're waiting for a text message to tell them when that meeting is going to be on. And you do sense there will be, at some point in the next few days, or maybe it might take a little bit longer, a compromise on the 2 metre thing, but not all the way back to 1 metre is the rumour on the ground in Leinster House at the moment, that possibly you're looking at 1.5 metres as being the compromise on this one.
I'd like to see anyone try and measure that. But in terms of geographically, Micheál, is there any theme here? Because obviously some counties have much lower rates of infection, have seen a much lower instance than anywhere else. So is there a sense that some rural counties are chafing under perhaps a large weight of infections or a larger weight of infections in Dublin, and them feeling they're suffering unnecessarily, where maybe a quiet rural pub has social distancing inbuilt anyway, simply because the clientele isn't there to fill it?
Yeah, there's definitely that. And isn't there also that sense that the tourist season is diminishing by the moment, and that if you did have something less than 2 metres in place as a requirement, that there is a way of saving that season, particularly down along the West Coast? I think that's where you can see a lot of pressure coming on politically. But there are some of the Dublin ministers as well raising the issue, and did so quite forcefully at Friday evening's cabinet meeting. It wasn't a majority, but it was forceful. I mean, that isn't the view at the top of government. And as it's the last time when we saw a push on as well around the easing of restrictions to move a little quicker, we know that Tony Hoolan met the cabinet ministers then. And he was forceful. He didn't budge on very much. At that point, it was the whole issue of cocooning and putting in some easing of the rules around that. It did happen in the end. I mean, it did happen on health advice, was the statement made. But that political pressure was key in those days leading up to that announcement. And you feel there is something at play again here at this moment.
People would have contrasted at the beginning of this, maybe the treatment of the advice of the Fiscal Advisory Council, and there are comments on budget measures being taken. They often expressed concern about maybe the amount of public spending as opposed to the absence of maybe the tax raising measures that they would have liked to have seen in place, but particularly we'll say on the spending area. But that was treated as advisory. Successive governments have just treated as advisory. NPHET has enjoyed a kind of a higher or a harder standard of evidence. Is there a creep towards, at least in some sectors of cabinet, trying to fiscal advisory councilize NPHET advice?
Yeah, you definitely will get one or two ministers who would like to go that route. It's not a view widely shared yet, but there is a feeling that the political system has to take back control. But at the same time, the political system will need cover if anything is to go wrong on this, and they will need that medical advice there. I think that realisation certainly exists at the top of government. It's just how strong the push comes. Even if you get past the 2 metre particular issue at the moment, then it will be on to moving a little quicker in terms of the roadmap. And already you can see the signals going out that if there is a continued decline in the number of people getting the virus, then things could move quicker. Those messages are probably going to come more frequently. But I don't, for the moment, see NPHET kind of becoming what the Fiscal Advisory Council became in the end, when I suppose most pointedly along the way when Michael Noonan took a different decision to them in one of those budgets when you were still in the middle of austerity. I don't think, given that the stakes are so high on this one, that option is necessarily there for the government at the moment.
Yeah, the old economists don't have to run for election type sentiment that was shown towards the Fiscal Advisory Council. But at the same time, I suppose the Taoiseach has said the 2 metre rule will stay in place. The business minister was on Morning Ireland this morning saying that that's where it is at the moment. But she did say it will be reviewed.
She did, and she was speaking about that cabinet meeting of June 5th. That's where you tee up what's going to happen on the 8th of June, which is the next phase on changing things and allowing a little bit more movement in the economy and in the society. Also, Simon Harris, the health minister, this morning about saying that remains the advice, 2 metres remains, but he used the term for now. So I think in the next few days you could see something around that. You could see some development towards easing it from 2 metres back a little bit, and that would probably be sufficient to quell the political tension that's beginning to bubble up here.
I think the last time we spoke, Micheál, you were kind of touching on the difficulties of stepping back from the emergency spending measures that were in place, and the pandemic unemployment payment is kind of emblematic of that. How will a €350 payment be stepped back from, if it is to be stepped back from, and how will the politics around that be managed in terms of it not being seen as austerity again?
Yeah, and you're seeing that already. Really strong words from Sinn Féin today saying that there shouldn't be any move towards stepping back on that. And then you can see the hints from the business minister, Heather Humphreys, this morning, hinting that it will be looked at, particularly that issue of people who are working part-time and maybe earning a little more now on the COVID payment, that's those kind of anomalies will be looked at. I suppose Cabinet on Friday is the likely place for these decisions to be taken. The expectation here and the word on the ground is that there's another possibly 3 months extension in it, in the payment and the temporary wage subsidy scheme as well. But it's not going to be an easy one, because I suppose the new government, whenever it does take power, if that is to happen, ending of that particular payment and those payments, that will be the first really big decision they will have to take. But you think that will be pushed out until September? Certainly that's the indication for now. You may get a hint of what's happening on Thursday, because on Thursday, all that extra spending that's going to have to take place at the Department of Social Protection to pay and fund these payments, though that vote and those estimates will have to go through the Dáil, and there may be an indicator at that point of what changes are on the cards.
I was listening to you on the politics podcast, Your Politics, yourself and our colleague Sandra Hurley had a difference of opinion as to when the government might be formed, Micheál. You weren't optimistic of it happening anytime soon, and certainly not with any great vigour. You thought they would all fall across the line eventually, tired of the negotiations and bet into shape maybe by some looming deadline like the need to renew the Special Criminal Court. Yeah. Do you see it going out that far?
Yeah, I think the Special Criminal Court is probably the big piece now that will focus minds. As it stands right now, I think the negotiations are looking at health and energy this morning. I think the three parties negotiating, there was a view last week they could get everything done by this Saturday night. That's now been pushed out possibly to about next Tuesday. And after that, so that's Tuesday week. After that point, you speak in a meaningful way to a number of independent TDs and see would they be in a position to support the agreement that had been reached. So then you're looking kind of the third week in June before everything is completed, and by everything you mean the votes then of the party memberships involved. So the third week or slightly beyond it in June is where we should know the result of this if it goes in a certain direction. I think fatigue will be the greatest force if this government is to get across the line, that sense of running out of options and having no choice but to travel this road.
There must be a sense of good fortune that they're not going through what the UK government is going through at the moment, having to explain the actions of an advisor. But maybe that's not a talking point you've heard any comment on today, Micheál.
No, there is relief on that point, and a look, kind of perplexed look as to how that could have unfolded in the UK. But I mean, the political sense here is that some serious and big decisions are on the way. And I mean, you're going to see that this week with the COVID payments, with possibly the 2 meter rule as well. And then that won't be sufficient in the end, because you can see it from the hairdressers and the barbers as well. If this gathers steam, which it looks like it will, that there will be real calls to move quicker than the fifth phase on the 10th of August. The politicians will want a lot to happen before then.
Right. 10 years ago, the controversy over haircuts in Irish politics was a much different thing, but that's it for today. All right. Thanks, Micheál.
Very good.
Cheers. Good luck. Bye-bye. And finally today to the UK, and at the time of recording this, Dominic Cummings, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson's advisor, is still in post, but he has been under pressure with calls for him to resign over a trip he took during the lockdown when the instructions were for people to stay at home. Several days of media stories eventually resulted in the unusual step of a government advisor giving a press conference. And in this, Mr. Cummings sought to explain that his wife and he were concerned that if they both became infected with coronavirus, they would have difficulty caring for their 4-year-old child. So they took a trip to his parents' farm in Durham to stay on a property there. And there, he said, his 2 nieces would be on hand to care for his child if needed. He said he believed this was allowed under the rules. And then he added that during his time in Durham, he took a drive to another town, Barnard Castle, to see if he could manage the drive back to London. He got out of the car and took a break by a river while there, and then another break on his way back to his parents' farm when his child needed a toilet break, which then turned into a short walk in the woods. In short, he was explaining as the old saying goes. So let's close today with an edited synopsis of media questions, and you, listener, can decide if in doing so he was losing.
No, I don't regret what I did. As I said, I think reasonable people may well disagree about how I thought about what to do in these circumstances, but I think that what I did was actually reasonable in these circumstances. In terms of the rules, I think that the rules make clear that if you're dealing with small children, then that can be exceptional circumstances, and I think that the situation that I was in was exceptional circumstances, and I think that the way that I dealt with it was the least risk to everybody concerned. Yes, I understand that people watching the media could be very upset about what's happened, but I've explained why.
Offer any regret, any apology to people who didn't have the ability to make the decisions that you did, who didn't have the resources to do what you did?
As I said, I think, I've thought a lot about what I did that over this period, what things I could have done better with this, what things I could have done better in general with dealing with the whole crisis. There's definitely a lot of things that I could have done better over the last few months, but I think what I did in this 14 days, I think that I behaved reasonably. I don't believe that I broke the rules. I think that
breaking the rules. It's that the SPIP and SPIM members last night said that they think you introduced the idea that if your personal circumstances allow, you can do something different from what the simple rules say, and they are very worried that will make it much harder to contain the spread of the disease.
Well, I think that they're right to be worried that the coverage of the last couple of days could encourage people to behave in certain ways, but with great respect to them, they made those comments without knowing what had actually happened. And actually, that's one of the reasons why I think now it would have been better to have made this statement earlier. But as it was, you know, well, I didn't.
With tracing perhaps kicking off in a big way in the coming weeks, people will be asked to isolate. The public health message will never have been more critical, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think public adherence to those instructions will be weaker or stronger as a result of your recent activities?
Well, I hope it won't affect it, and I hope that that now that people know what actually happened, and that some of the false stories that have all been circulating and driving a lot of people understandably mad about it, then I hope that people will realise.
Hi. You blame the media for this mess that you've got the government into. Do you accept that you've, whatever legal nicety you may have to say that you haven't broken the letter of these regulations, you've driven a coach and horses through the spirit of them, and that is why people are so cross about it?
I don't agree. I think that that's not...
You don't agree?
No, I don't agree.
So let's go through it, shall we? I mean, you left London with your wife, who had coronavirus symptoms, completely against the regulations. You're up in Durham, and you decide to go for a drive on a weekend when, a few yards from here, the Foreign Secretary that weekend was telling us to stay at home and save lives. You went for a drive, you sat by a river, you went for a walk in the wood. I mean, you may or may not have a way of justifying this to yourself, and possibly there may be some legal loophole, but you've broken the spirit of it, haven't you?
No, I don't think that I have.
So there are people without gardens, never mind access to private land and woodland, who haven't made unnecessary car journeys like that for more than 2 months now. They've been following rules that you helped forge and create. So were the public stupid to follow these rules to the letter, rather than looking for loopholes like you did?
No, of course the public were not stupid to follow the rules, and I wasn't looking for loopholes. I was looking to try to do the best that I could in a complex situation.
Final one from me. What is your message from Conservative voters who voted this government in less than 6 months ago, a lot of them for the first time in the North East around Durham, who want you out of Downing Street and want you out of this government?
What's my message to them? Well, I think I've made mistakes in how I've dealt with this. All sorts of things in government. I don't think I made a mistake about these 14 days that are in question, and I would I would stress to people that they should not believe everything they read in the newspapers or everything they see on TV, because lots of the things that are reported are not in fact the case.
And that's all for this episode of Pandemic. We're back tomorrow with more. In the meantime, do get in contact with suggestions or questions by email to colm.omongain@rte.ie. That's colm.omongain@rte.ie. Or on Twitter @colm.omongain. Do subscribe through your usual podcast platform to get this podcast regularly. Reviews are welcome. And of course, nice reviews even more welcome. So until tomorrow, take care. So long.